You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Josh. How are you?
I'm good, Glenn. How are you today?
Doing very well. This is Glenn Lowry, The Glenn Show at BloggingHeads.tv. I also teach at Brown University. I'm talking with Joshua Cohen of Apple University and the Boston Review. And he also teaches at the UC Berkeley Law School. And we've been here before, Josh.
Yeah. Good to be back on the Glenn Show, Glenn.
Oh, thanks. I don't know. I'm sort of getting tired of the Glenn Show, Josh. I mean, it's an amazing thing to acknowledge, but I've been doing this since you introduced me to bloggingheads.tv back in 2007. So it's coming up on a decade. That's a nice round number.
Uh-oh, that sounds like a retirement speech.
To be honest with you, in my late 60s, just having returned from the memorial service for my dear friend Tom Schelling, the great economist who passed away last December at the age of 95, watching my dad age, as we will all do. He's going to be 88 on his next birthday. One of the archipelago of villages in Central Florida, where relatively well-heeled seniors are all congregating around golf courses and such. That's where my dad decided to decamp to, 25 years ago. Uh-huh. And aware of my own mortality, that's a long-winded way, excuse me, Josh, I'm taking the privilege of the moderator.
It's all right.
And I have to start thinking about, what am I doing with my time? Every minute is precious. Every day will never be. I'm talking to a guy who I know understands this, will never come again. And so stuff that is not, everything's got to click. It's got to all kind of cohere, or else, because, there's only one life to live here,
There's only one life to give and to give also, but one life to live. And as we say, we're not going to get this 1 hour back. So we should, make good use of it. And the fact that we're not going to get it back, of course, that's always true, but it seems more poignantly true. Now, you mentioned the Tom Schelling. It reminds me that Ken Arrow, as you know, passed away.
Did know that, yes.
Yeah. I'll just take the occasion to say I had the I did have the pleasure and privilege of knowing him and at Stanford. And I actually sat in on his microeconomics course a long time ago when I was a graduate student at Harvard. And what a remarkable, decent, brilliant, extraordinary person. The thing for people who haven't seen him, you'll know what I mean, since you have. You'd be in a seminar with Ken, and it didn't really matter much what the topic was, and he'd be sitting there. He's like, I'm thinking of things that were 5 or 6 years ago. So he died. He was 95 or 96, so he'd be 90 years old. And, his pants were like up at his neck, and he'd be kind of slouched over the table and, making a mess of the sandwich that he was eating for lunch. And he had this kind of mumbly way of talking, and he'd start to make a point. And sometimes I'd be sitting there thinking, I'm going to walk with this computer, Glenn, because I've got to go plug it in someplace, but I'll plug it on the line. You'd think, oh, Ken, why are you saying this? It's kind of often left. This is an incredibly smart, brilliant point. I wish I had thought of it myself. In addition to just being, an extraordinarily brilliant and creative guy who made amazing, he was just an incredibly decent human being, kind and generous and thoughtful. And so anyway, a brief memorial.
And modest, Josh, because when you think about the prodigious contributions that he made to social thought, economic theory. You think about Social Choice and Individual Values, a book which I'm sure you know well. And, you know, you start with the voting paradoxes, you know, the Condorcet paradox or whatever, but you end up with this, and I won't try to, you know, explain what he does in the book, but just to give some sense of the magnitude of the achievement, with this general formulation of a question that people didn't even know how to ask the question, let alone answer the question.
Yeah. You know, where Arrow's theorem came from, let me just mention, I had the privilege of the first time I read Social Choice and Individual Values was in a graduate seminar that John Rawls was teaching. So I learned about basics of social choice theory and Arrow's theorem from John Rawls. And I also had the pleasure and privilege of teaching Arrow's theorem in a seminar that many years later I taught with Amartya Sen.
So,
you know, he tells the story that he was at Rand Corporation in the late 1940s. He was a PhD student at Columbia, and he was writing a dissertation on some issues in growth theory with John Hicks, with Sir John Hicks. But he's at Rand, and this is right after von Neumann-Morgenstern game theory. And a lot of people are thinking about the application of game theory to international relations or relations between states, particularly as they're starting to think about issues about nuclear weapons, et cetera. And so somebody, a mathematician who's at Rand, comes to Arrow, who's a graduate student, and says, you know, I don't really understand this application of game theory to relations between states, because game theory is about, you know, the agents there. You have these individually rational agents. States are, you know, aggregates. And so how do you treat them as agents? And so he thought he would try to explain to this person the basics of the Bergson-Samuelson social welfare function. And then, as he tells the story, 3 weeks later, he had the basics of his Arrow's theorem. So it came
3 weeks later.
Yeah.
I think the listening audience needs to know that the problem that Arrow is addressing in this book is how and whether it's possible to take a society which consists of many individuals who will have different values and preferences about social choice, and in a systematic and coherent way, aggregate across those individuals so that from the point of view of the overall society, the decision making can also be understood as the implementation of a rational choice criterion. Can I construct a criterion for the society that respects individuals in a way that has to be specified precisely? And Arrow demonstrates that if you want that way of doing things to be reasonable, it's not possible to do as a general matter. Pardon?
Except with a dictator. So you can get rationality.
You can name one person and then his preferences would be respected and he would be coherent and rational.
Right. You get rationality with a dictator and you don't get rationality over with a collection of individuals if you think that the social policy should aggregate, reflect, be based on the preferences of individuals. Now, there's, as some listeners doubtless will know, there is a vast literature on trying to find ways to address the difficulty and et cetera. But as a device, as a way of clarifying your thinking about a fundamental problem, about how do you combine democracy with its attentiveness to individuals treated as equals and rationality in social policy, you can't start any better place than Arrow's theorem. Anyway.
This is what, 1949, 1950?
I think the book was published in 51.
Okay, so, and Ken is not 30 years old when this is happening? Yeah, I think that's right.
He's about 30. Yeah, he was about 30. And
it's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And one last point on this, which is, Arrow's theorem is an incredible achievement. In addition to the theorem, the book is filled with really interesting insights on a whole bunch of problems that are related to but not part of the theorem. So wonderful human being, extraordinary contribution. There was a very, I thought, touching, affecting obituary for him that Larry Summers wrote. Now, Larry Summers doesn't usually write touching and affecting things, but, you know, Ken Arrow was his uncle, and he described being at a party after Ken Arrow got the Nobel Prize. And there was a party at the home of his other uncle, Paul Samuelson, and he describes the scene at this party. And it was really a lovely.
Gotta look that one up. I've not seen it. Of course, this does not exhaust Arrow's contribution, okay?
Yeah.
He's also the father of modern general equilibrium theory in economics, along with Gerard Debreu.
Yeah.
He's also the father of modern health economics with an essay that he probably tossed off in his spare time somewhere in the early mid-1960s, in which he nails all these problems of adverse selection and moral hazard that economists have built the edifice of health economics on. He's also the father of the learning by doing. You know, you say his dissertation was on growth theory, so this endogenous growth.
Growth theory.
I mean, so anyway, hats off to a great man. May he rest in peace.
Really wonderful, wonderful human being.
Josh, we have to turn.
We're trying to stay on this high plane.
To talk about
drop off.
The address to the joint session of Congress that the President of the United States, one Donald J. Trump, delivered on Tuesday. We're 3 days beyond that. And amidst much, discussion back and forth, the speech has been praised by some as more presidential than anybody had reason to think that Donald J. Trump was capable of being. It's been panned by others as look at his policies. Anybody can read from a teleprompter and say nice words. And I'm wondering what your reactions might be.
I'm a little closer to the anybody can read from a teleprompter and say nice words than I am to the Van Jones and others who said Donald Trump has now become president. It certainly is true that the tone was different. As somebody said, it was nationalism in an inside voice. The tone was, it was a good line. Nationalism. The tone was different, and I think the fact that the tone was different served him well. I think it was pretty well received. I guess the reason that I'm but still closer to the anybody can read from a teleprompter and say, I mean, there's also been some incredibly extravagant praise. I was just reading something that I think is, kind of a delusional piece about comparing this to the Gettysburg Address. I mean, I'm glad you respond the same way.
Well, no, here's a more modest formulation, which is that this is a template for future joint session addresses for presidents going forward.
Yeah, that was Tucker Carlson's remark, I think, was that it was a template. I thought that comment was a template for future horseshit. I mean, please.
Hold on just a minute. Excuse me. I have to go get something out of my oven. I happen to be sitting in my kitchen. I don't want it to burn, okay?
I don't want your house to burn down, so go right ahead and get it. I don't want your house to burn down, and I don't want you to go hungry either. So,
yeah, and I don't want to waste a nice piece of meat. So,
no, God.
Okay, I'm all set.
Okay.
Tucker Carlson, horseshit.
That was the next comment that I was about. I just think this is kind of, silly. I mean, Barack Obama made some great speeches. He made lots of speeches that were fine, that were light. And I thought this one was fine. I didn't think it was.
Well, low expectations. That's the thing, right? The bar is low.
Okay. So on the policy substance.
Can I say one thing before we go there?
Yeah.
Which is maybe to push back a little bit with you on the. No, anyone can read from a teleprompter, no doubt about that. And it's obvious somebody who knows how to write better than Donald Trump knows how to write wrote that speech. But isn't there a sense in which Van Jones is right that the normalization process, that is the process of the acceptance of the fact of Donald Trump as the president of the United States, not my president be damned, he's the president, was advanced materially by that address, even though it did amount to simply having the guy read from a teleprompter and not ad lib incoherently.
Yeah.
The net effect of it and the way in which people responded to certain of the props that he, I mean, with respect, I do mean, but people in the audience that would be pointed to and the devices you know, that were being exploited there did have the effect, did it not, of normalizing. Now, when people wrote, and I'll stop, that the Democrats, those who were sitting on their hands and not knowing whether to stand and applaud or not applaud or whatever, looked a little churlish, maybe a little peevish, you know, this is the president. You know, and notwithstanding that for so long, so many people have said, no, never, never, never.
Yeah.
And inexorably, he gets normalized.
Yeah. So, you know, so I think I know I'm not alone in thinking that, you know, Donald Trump, I think, is a loathsome and ignorant narcissist. But I don't think that's the, you know, what's most important about Donald Trump. I think what's most important is what he's trying to do, not that he's a loathsome and ignorant narcissist.
Right.
And I think there's been way too much focus on the fact that he is a loathsome and ignorant narcissist.
The post, I would amend to say post-election. Pre-election, the argument about his character, it strikes me, was entirely apt. It shouldn't have been the only argument, but it was certainly post-election. You got a guy, he's going to make policies. That's all that. I mean, you got to deal with that. Yeah. I mean, whether he's loathsome is kind of not all that relevant.
You know, I think we've talked about this before. There was a piece, it was a New York Times op-ed piece about the Italian politicians who were successful against Berlusconi, including Romano Prodi. And what the argument was that the people who were successful against Berlusconi were the people who didn't pay attention to his personality, but paid attention to his policy. And I think there's been, and maybe it was okay before the election, certainly after the election, too much attention to the qualities of personality. So then when he shows up in a different way,
It has this normalizing effect.
Then you do have to talk about what really matters, which is what the.
Okay, so let's talk about
that. Let's talk a little bit about the. And just one other thing, though, on that, which is, you know, this is somebody who I think has consistently been underestimated by his critics and enemies. He beat 17 people for the Republican nomination. And if when you asked on day one, are these bozos, who's going to win the nomination? You know, some people would have said Scott Walker and some people, you know, would have said Marco Rubio. And some people would have said, a lot of people would have said Jeb Bush. They didn't seem like bozos until, you know, over the. So there's and then he, you know, he didn't win the popular vote, but he beat Hillary Clinton in the and he took a lot of hits in the campaign, and he had showed a bunch of resilience he was in for the long game. And I think people just didn't appreciate you know, there was some real strength there. And I think anyway, so he's been underestimated and all this focus on personality on the policy substance. You know, I think there wasn't really anything new, different, surprising on healthcare, the reform, repeal, revision of the replacement of the Affordable Care Act. There was nothing new, different on the tax issue, on the immigration issue, despite a head fake that in the run up to the speech about how there was going to be a, you know, path to citizenship. And then they, you know, the administration basically said afterwards, yeah, that was a bluff that we, and nothing really new on infrastructure.
Immigration, not citizenship, I thought. I thought the path was to legalization of status, not citizenship. It's an important distinction.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's a but, and I'm sorry for
no problem. No, no,
just no, no, you're absolutely right. And in fact, I think this may have been by design. I don't know, but if you think in each of those areas, there's not only a fight between the Democrats and the Republicans, there's a lot of fight among the Republicans, like on the Affordable Care Act stuff, or on taxes, on, you know, on the issue about border adjustment, which is a, you know, is a very big fight about that. And on all of the issues of controversy, the speech was completely noncommittal. So it didn't say, I'm going to be sending legislation that is going to reduce the corporate tax rate to, you know, 15% or 20% or whatever, that is going to include a, you know, a border adjustment provision that'll make up for the revenue that we lose from the reduction of the rates. The reduction of the rates is going to result in an, you know, a large inflow of resources into the country. It was very noncommittal, you know, on all the, and similarly on infrastructure, very noncommittal on all. So it wasn't really a program, didn't really take positions. And I think, and this goes to the issue, I'm going to say something now that I think is a next step, which goes to the issue about being, you know, presidential. I mean, there was a presentation of being presidential in the form of, it's time for us to come together, these invocations of coming together, time for us to stop the, you know, fights that have, you know, kept us from moving forward on the issues that really matter, which is the issues facing the people that, you know, who have sent us here to solve some real problems. Those words were there, but they weren't backed by any kind of substantive moves to say, to Democrats, to people who, you know, either partisan differences or political differences of the nonpartisan kind, here's how we can come together. For example, he could on immigration have come out in a way maybe that only he could, because of his bona fides on the immigration issue, with a path to legalization. That would have been a presidential gesture. He didn't. He could have come out and said, you know, I mean, not exactly in these words, you know, I have discovered that healthcare, as he said, it's a complicated thing. It's really complicated. And I've also I have a deeper appreciation now of the accomplishments of the Affordable Care Act in extending coverage to lots of people who didn't have it before, in getting rid of pre-existing conditions. And the legislation is fundamentally flawed, but it had, you know, these important elements. And what we really need to do, and use the language of, you know, repeal and replace if you want, what we really need to do is, you know, preserve those, you know, gains that you got to do something, you know, better and different. There was an opportunity to do that. And he came sort of close when he listed the principles that should guide, including, you know, access. He didn't say non-discrimination, but access, irrespective of pre-existing conditions. So I thought I didn't think that there was anything new and different and I didn't think there was a real substantive gesture of,
okay, I want to address this latter, Josh, excuse me for interrupting. And I'm sitting here, you know, trained as a game theorist in graduate school, thinking about the general problem of de-escalation. So you wanted him in a way to kind of walk back. You wanted him to soften some of the edge. You wanted him to extend a hand. Okay, and of course, that's what he should do if he wants to be president of all the people and govern the country. But how do you do that, or how do you get there? That's the end point. That's the goal. But you're in conflict. You're in conflict with partisan. I mean, the Democratic women dressed in white who were sitting there half the arena stands, half of the assembled stand and applaud, the other half sit on their hands and so forth. You're picking up the newspaper and you're reading one after another negative story. You know that there are forces that are trying to bring you down. So, I mean, for example, if he flip-flops too blatantly, the story will be, he had no principles. I told you all along he was a charlatan. Why should we believe with what he says right now? Or something like that. The metaphor I have in mind is it's a tug of war. I've got two teams pulling on a rope. They're at a standoff. Nobody's getting pulled over the line either way. Everybody's getting tired. They want to scale down. They want to go home and eat dinner. But they don't want to lose. So how do you unravel a tense situation of conflict when you know that any sign of weakness could lead to you being pulled over the line?
Well, but that situation, as you learned in the game theory courses, is completely symmetrical. So, what you described, first of all, about people sitting on their hands, about, you know, impassive looks, even when gestures are made in your direction, you could have been describing the speeches that Obama made to Congress, for that matter. You could have been describing. Yeah, this is the problem, and it's policy making suffers from it. It is.
Many Democrats criticized the president back in the day, President Obama, for being too forthcoming in trying to extend a hand and not recognizing the implacability of the forces on the other side.
Exactly. And here's the difference. So it's true that if there's this fear of appear on everybody's part, there's a fear of appearing weak.
Right.
I'm not going to use the now current jargon for appearing weak. I'm just going to stay away from there. But anyway, you know what I'm talking about. Everybody's afraid of appearing weak, and appearing weak is identified with making any kind of gesture that, you know, a genuine substantive gesture, which is then perceived as a sign of weakness. And as soon as you show weakness, then, you know, the barracudas are going to come after you. But then all the stuff about we need to come together is bullshit. Because you're saying we need to come together, but I'm not going to do anything. We're just going to keep playing the same game that you described. It's like somebody who's pulling on the rope and they take a breath for a second and they say, why don't we all work on this together? And you say, oh, that, and then they go yank and they pull it. You
know? I've come to a slightly different conclusion. My conclusion is that given the dilemma that you've described, the only possibility of progress is that progress which is made in small steps. I make a little concession as a kind of opportunity for the other side to signal back to me their interest in this mutual goal of de-escalation by matching in some way or another. So when the president starts his speech by saying this is the last day of Black History Month, there are a couple of ways you can understand that. One is with, you know, your cynic's hat on and just say, oh, come on, give me a break. You're the most racist guy that's ever occupied the office. What are you talking about? You're just saying that. Another way of understanding it is this is a kind of opening salvo, a kind of initial step to try to indicate I at least have an interest in trying to tamp down some of this talk about anti-Semitism in this administration and about indifference to race. I at least have an interest. And to the extent that it's met not with a simple, sneer, but with some kind of gesture, we could imagine what it might be on the other side, then it's possible to take other steps and maybe move in a more virtuous circled kind of direction.
You know, I saw something that in a very extended and attenuated sense of friend, my friend Richard Spencer tweeted about. I do know Richard. We had a interesting breakfast together in D.C. a couple of weeks ago and talked about lots of stuff.
A couple of weeks ago and you didn't get punched out?
Not at all. There was no punching. Nobody punched anybody. And it was a it was an interesting conversation. He tweeted something like, okay, when we got past the stuff about the anti-Semitic acts, the cemeteries and stuff, he said, okay, all right, so the PC bullshit part of the speech is done. Now we're getting to Trump.
The thing is, I'm trying to imbue it with some significance, and he's giving it back to him.
Yeah, and the hermeneuticists of suspicion are hot on the trail of bullshit. But I thought I don't know exactly what to make of this. But if I were looking for, a very different kind of gesture, this appointment of Fiona Hill from Brookings, who's a Russia expert and a Putin critic, as the, White House Russia person, that I think is kind of interesting. I don't know where that comes from. She's very widely respected.
I was unaware of this, so please educate me. Go ahead.
Yeah, she's a.
This the NSC, the National Security Council?
Yeah, she's right. So she's not at the State Department. She's
in the White House. Okay.
Yeah, and she's a very highly regarded a person on Russia. I have no expertise on this, so I'm just deferring to what appears to be a very widespread judgment of her from people who are expert on this. They think very highly of her judgment, and she's been very consistently a Putin critic. There was you can get a short piece on this. She did something on Vox last year during the campaign, and it was about why. Her piece was about, among other things, why Putin might want to influence the American election. And it was about what Putin is like. And I've seen lots of stuff by people who, as I say, are unlike me, genuinely knowledgeable about Russia, knowledge of U.S.-Russia relations. And they were they sort of sat up straight.
I see.
It wouldn't be quite like saying, we've asked Jeff Sessions to submit his resignation and we've asked Loretta Lynch to, take his place.
It wouldn't be like that. No,
it's not like that, but it's,
something like that though, you think? Fiona Harris, did you say?
Fiona Hill. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. So, but you asked the original question was about the speech. Was this just same old with the inside voice, or was this some new effort at serious effort at being? Whatever exactly this means in this very divided at being presidential. The reason that I said I was closer to the same old with an inside voice is because I think there were some ways of doing things on these, on the policy issues, would have sent a stronger signal. Now, maybe, you think it would have sent a signal, would have been treated as a signal of weakness, as if Trump had recognized that he actually is extremely unpopular for a president at this stage of the game. And, he was getting a little bit desperate and thought he needed to reach out. And then, people were going to, I'm not worried about that, about him. I don't think he's in deep danger of, in a way that other people, of projecting weakness by making more than baby steps. He's got an opportunity to do it, and he didn't do it.
Okay. Duly noted. I want to ask you something else, though, Josh. I detected, and it's probably more Steve Bannon, based on what I've been reading, than Donald J. Trump, but I've detected the kind of broadest outlines of a doctrine about nationalism. You say nationalism with an inside voice. America yeah. first. I'm not the president of the world. I'm not here to represent the world. I'm here to represent the United States of America. If people come to our country, they need to love our country and love what we stand for. The contrast between a more, how do I want to put this, America as a global citizen.
Yeah, cosmopolitan. Let's call it cosmopolitan.
That's the word I was searching for. Thank you. We can just cut right to the chase. The contrast. Now, Obama was very cosmopolitan. I mean, in his, you know, approach to all kind of issues from climate, change and global warming to relations with the Arab world, which he was seeing in a very complicated and nuanced way to, deference to allies. Some called it leading from behind with a sneer, but a sense that we don't go it alone. We look for it, you know. We're trying to build consensus and so forth and so on. I'm not an expert in foreign policy, but it seems to me that this is a big, big contrast.
Yes.
And I haven't heard it rebutted. This is where I'm trying to get to. What I've not heard is Democrats say, oh, no, not America first. Yes. No, that's wrong in principle. That's the wrong way to be thinking about what it means to be in the 21st century, where the earth, where the viruses, Nick Kristof wrote this in the New York Times this morning, the viruses can cross any border, anything like that. The planet has a single climate, not a climate that gets bounded by national borders and such. And we're citizens of the world. We need to think about this in a different... So is this doctrine going to get adequately vetted, or is it just simply going to be kind of snuck in through the back door, as it were, without us having a full deliberation as a country about exactly what it means to be a citizen of the United States vis-a-vis mm-hmm. being a citizen of the world? I mean, I see this, and I'll stop, coming up in the refugee issues, okay?
Absolutely.
We should be good Samaritans. We should open our doors to people who are in need. Well, the immigration issue with respect to, well, we should have a merit-based immigration system. So if you got $150 million or you got a PhD in astrophysics, you're welcome. But if you're just a guy who wants to pick potatoes up out of the ground, no, we can do without you. So I mean, what do you think about that?
So first of all, I agree, and I think this was pretty clear during the campaign, that he was running as as some kind of nationalist, whether as a civic nationalist, attentive to the idea of the nation, understood the way Lincoln understood the nation, as conceived in an idea and dedicated to a proposition, or as a more ethnic nationalist, somebody who thinks it's there are lots of different variants of nationalism, I was having a dispute on Twitter once with a very reactionary guy. I mean, that's how he would have described himself, as a reactionary guy, who described Trump as a milquetoast civic nationalist, you know, as distinct from. Mention Richard Spencer, and his one of his responses to the speech was that there shouldn't be a merit-based immigration system. There should be a race-based immigration system. So that's not civic nationalism. So I agree that there is this is. I think was pretty clear during the campaign that this was anti-cosmopolitan, or as they would have put it, anti-globalist, and that there was an assertion of some form of nationalism. And by the way, I think it was pretty clear before Steve Bannon joined the campaign that was the direction, that was the unifying thread in Trump's views. I also think, there, at least in the political arena, there has not been the kind of conversation that you're describing. There has not been a kind of taking the bull by the horns and saying, you know, we're all God's children. We're a world of human beings of equal moral importance, and we all have hopes and opportunities and abilities and something to contribute, or, you know, something like that. And yes, it's true that we are a world of such individuals that's, you know, where there are borders and territories and states. And that's okay. You don't have to have completely open borders, but your way of relating to the rest of the world should reflect the fact that there are things that you owe to people outside your borders, because we're all of equal moral importance. I don't think that that has been joined. And I think one of the reasons that it's hard to have that argument is, and there's, I think we may have talked, there was this piece that Angus Deaton, the Nobel Prize economist, wrote about a year ago, where this is what Deaton said. It was a very short but very helpful piece. He said, look, for a long time, I, Angus Deaton, have been, you know, to use a phrase with too many syllables, a cosmopolitan prioritarian. Cosmopolitan, everybody matters equally. Prioritarian, you give the most concern to people who are in the worst situation. You know, you assign priority to improving the conditions of the circumstances of people who are worst off. And then he said, and this was what he said was, well, we've been doing that. That's been, you know, a kind of guiding idea for a bunch of us. And the consequence of that is that people in lots of places in the world, Chinese middle class, a bunch of people in India, have done a lot better as a consequence of globalism. First time we've talked about this, first time in human history that fewer than 10% of the world's population is living in extreme poverty, living standards double, infant mortality, et cetera, et cetera. But he says, the people who are making that argument about all these benefits are people who also have done really, really well over the past 20 years. And the people who have done least well, this is Branko Milanovic's elephant curve, the people who've done least well over the past 20 years are the people are like in the American middle class who've lost a bunch of income, and not just the American. So that has made it very hard, I think, to say, no, not America first, or yes, we do owe something. Maybe not equal consideration, but we do owe something to people who are outside our borders. It morally matters that globalism, for all its deficiencies, it morally matters that globalism hugely improved the living standards of a lot of people in the world. That matters. Hard to say that.
So the fact that the benefits of globalization have accrued disproportionately both to the world's most poor, yes, and to the wealthy countries' upper and upper middle classes,
exactly,
leaves a politician in the wealthy country, like a Democratic politician facing Trump, less politically able to advocate on behalf of the values that underlay the global improvement of living standards for the most disadvantaged, kind of cuts against cosmopolitan yes, prioritization.
Yeah, prioritarian. Yeah. Yes.
As a political matter, but if you had told me that integrating the schools in the South or breaking down Jim Crow was something that it would be very easy for wealthy white Southerners to advocate for, but for the working class white guy, it was a tougher lift. And that's why George Wallace is standing in the schoolhouse door, or Lester Maddox is taking after people with an axe handle. The reason they're doing it is they're responding to the Democratic imperative of looking out for, you know, a good old boy who doesn't see any benefits and only costs coming to him from desegregation. If you had told me that, I would have said, you have your head up your moral butt. The right thing to do here is to stand up for what's the right thing to do. And it's most important to do so at a time when the political cost of doing so might be highest.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
I mean, I'm worried that if this thing, for example, let me just give one example. I know I'm talking, but on the op-ed page in New York Times just a few days ago, George Borjas had a piece about immigration.
Yeah.
The last line of that piece says, you know, their benefits and their costs from immigration, the costs are mostly borne by our people who are, you know, lower class, on it, whatever. Who are you rooting for? If your reaction to the immigration dilemma is not to maximize the well-being of our people, then just who are you rooting for? And that's a dare. That's daring somebody to say, I'm rooting for the marginal peasant coming out of a village in Vietnam. And the reason I'm rooting for him is because he's one of the least advantaged people on this planet.
Yeah. Well, Karl Marx had an answer to this. The answer was workers of the world unite. And I mean, to make that, you know, more than just a, you know, a kind of, you know, joke slogan, there is the answer or an answer, but it's a, you know, this is, it's complicated. It's hard. It's politics. It's democratic politics. It's hard business. The answer is that you have to say that you know, to George Borjas. I mean, there are two things to say to George Borjas. First of all, as you know, a lot of people who've looked at the same questions that George Borjas has looked at do not come to the same conclusions that he's come to. So Michael Clemens at the Center for Global Development just had a piece, did an analysis on the end of the Braceros agricultural immigration program in the mid-1960s. And the answer was that the end of the program didn't produce increases in wages and employment for people in the United States. What it produced was technological change. I mean, you know, it's an economic analysis. It's a familiar one. I think the more the disagreement that you have, that one can have with Borjas, which goes more to the immediate topic that we've got here, is you say, I don't have to make a choice between, you know, the Mexican peasant who's immigrating and people here. But what I have to do is, and this is a matter of politics and policy, I have to find things that are good for them, not good for the immigrant who's is going to work for a big farm, and the big farmer is going to be pretty happy about it, and the immigrant is going to be better off, or whether they're happy about it, they're going to be better off for it. And what you've done, it's divide and conquer rather than people.
So I'm coming up with this off the top of my head, and maybe it's a dumb idea, but why not tax the profits of the farm concern that employs the immigrant labor and create a fund to offset the displacement cost and other kind of difficulties of the incumbent population who might be
It's a great idea as the beginning of a conversation. And what's in the back of your mind is that the immigration and the benefits to the farmer, it's producing a Caldor Hicks improvement, right? It's a compensable injury, but that's exactly what you're thinking. And you could summarize, you know, the unhappy contribution of your discipline to the discussion of these trade and immigration issues over the past, you know, 30 years by way of saying that everybody has smugly invoked the idea of Caldor Hicks improvements without ever working hard to actually get the compensation in place, as opposed to say it's a welfare improvement, which means that you could pay the compensation.
Exactly.
And the same is thing.
I did want people to understand when you say Caldor Hicks improvement, you mean it's in principle possible that everyone could be made better off if the right redistributive policy accompanies the thing that's being evaluated. But people will cite that as saying, see, it's good, quote unquote, good in an unadulterated way, without ever worrying about the political endgame of making sure that redistribution actually takes place.
Yeah, and the redistribution needn't, and you know, it's redistribution in a very exactly right, what you just said. But I just want to clarify, it's redistribution in a kind of an abstract sense of the term. It's not like it needn't be take the policy needn't take the form of, you know, tax and income transfer, although it could take that form. The redistribution could take the form of a kind of an active labor market policy, where you have serious investment in making sure that there is relief for people who've been injured by, you know, imports from countries who are, you know, this is the, you know, the NAFTA or China WTO accession issues. This where so what you do is you don't rule out the agreement, but you make sure that there's some kind of assistance, at least some transitional assistance for people who are injured by it. And I think there's been. And then what you're in the situation, you're not in the situation of saying, do I have to choose between this person and that person? You know, the person who's, you know, in the, you know, lower middle class in, you know, China versus middle class in the United States. But you try to get some gains for both of them. And
good. Now, I want to ask you one more thing. It's this very same spirit. This is about the president's joint session speech, and I think it's the last thing we're going to be able to talk about. And that is
true for one second before you did that. I just want to underscore the importance of the topic that you just introduced. I think there has not been the kind of conversation about this kind of nationalism, cosmopolitanism. You know, in the mid-1990s, I edited a book with a lead essay. This is a Boston Review thing, with a lead essay by Martha Nussbaum.
Yeah.
And the title was "For Love of Country?" And Martha had the lead essay, and there were contributions to the book by Michael Walzer and Gertrude Himmelfarb and Amartya Sen and Elaine Scarry and, you know, it was a, you know, Judith Butler. It was a but it was exactly on, and Anthony Appiah. It was exactly on this issue about the, what are the merits and limitations of nationalism, patriotism, and of cosmopolitanism. And I think the people who have some kind of, you know, cosmopolitan point of view are back on their heels right now and not carrying the fight that you've identified. So I just want to give a big yes to the topic. Anyway, sorry for go back to the question. Yeah,
I'm glad you extended your remarks. Now, this is not unrelated. Voice, victims of immigrant crime engaged. If that's what it stands for. I think that's what it stands for.
Yeah.
So the president has these props. And again, I don't mean this in a pejorative way. I just mean it literally, okay? Yeah. People sitting up in the gallery who are the surviving relatives of people murdered by unauthorized immigrants. And he trots them out and, you know, he points to them. And everybody, of course, has to stand and honor these people. They're... Yeah. Surviving. I mean, if you don't, you look like what an asshole is this? On the other hand, I have not run the numbers on this. Okay, but you know, the criminal, alien, drug dealing murderer has got to be like 1 in 100 of the people who are crossing the border. Okay, let it be 3 in 100. It's got to be a really, really small number. Okay. Yeah. So how much weight in our consciousness should the fact of victimization, a horrible thing in every case, okay? It's a horrible thing in every case, but we don't stop driving cars because there are automobile accidents, et cetera, et cetera. Should we stop letting people cross the border because 1 in 100 or 3 out of 100 of them might be somewhat unsavory or worse? And is this the way to kind of motivate a national discussion about these issues? It feels very, very manipulative. It reminds me of the run-up to the mass incarceration state, where a district attorney somewhere who wants to get elected, attorney general of her state will trot out a crime victim. And, you know, the fact that we got the death penalty for the assailant as a way of signaling to the polity that, you know, we're standing with you.
I agree with you very much. I think 3 in 100, even 1 in 100, is probably very. I'm guessing. I haven't read that. Those are very high estimates. Although the answer on the other side will be, yeah, but there are, you know, you know, millions of people in the country, although the number of people come, you know, it's kind of diminishing. You want to make a case about crime in the country. I mean, you know, just this strikes me. I don't quite know how to draw a sharp line between doing the voice thing and having the victims. And I suppose next year at this time, there's a program, there's a law and order program focused on black-on-black crime. And there are a bunch of victims in the gallery. You know, it would not be that would be kind of, I would regard that as a bad thing myself.
And awful. That would be an awful.
Intolerable. It would be intolerable. And now you were right that this is connected to the previous conversation about the nationalism, cosmopolitanism, because I can hear somebody saying, no, we would never do that. Of course, I can hear somebody saying we should do that, but somebody saying we would never do that because those are all our co-nationals. So pumping up public sentiment around something on the backs of the public humiliation of co-nationals, that's not okay. But pumping up public sentiment around an issue by humiliating the people who are not co-nationals, that's just fine because we don't owe anything to them. And by the way, I think that is exactly the sensibility that we don't owe anything, so it doesn't matter what we do. That is exactly the sensibility that informed the president's executive order on immigration, which was described in a fantastic blog post by Ben Wittes at Lawfare Blog as a document that was whose malevolence was fortunately tempered by its incompetence. Malevolence because it gave absolutely no importance to even the concerns of existing visa holders, or in its initial implementation, green card holders, or people who had already gone through a substantial refugee vetting process, or, you know, but I think the sensibility was, the America First sensibility was, that's okay, because they're not co-nationals. We don't owe them anything.
Yeah, I agree. You put it very well. And I want to add, if such a posture is not explicitly identified and rebutted, you stand onto a slippery slope down into a moral sewer. These arguments have to be engaged. You can't just let this kind of stuff go by without rebuttal. And the political expediency, who wants to be in the position of arguing on the side of a, quote, criminal alien, close quote? There goes a human being just like you or I. The fact that they were born in Juarez and not in San Diego is irrelevant to their worth as a human being. Who wants to be in the position of arguing that when the opponents are trotting out the mother or the wife of the murder victim or whatever, whatever? But there's a terrible cost to pay if those arguments are not engaged.
I completely agree, and I have a seminar this afternoon on the immigration executive order that ends with a conversation about nationalism and cosmopolitanism as the sensibilities that really I think are underlying it. I think there has to be a very open and explicit engagement, and I think it's got to begin with people who have, you know, as in this Martha Nussbaum piece, which was a very self-conscious embrace of a cosmopolitan outlook. I think it has to start with people who are prepared to get up and say, I'm a more, and you can find subtle positions in between, but I think we need the other position articulated, which is I'm a moral cosmopolitan. I think everyone is of equal moral importance, that establishes substantial obligations to people outside your borders. Whether it leads to an open borders policy or not is a different issue. I don't think it need lead to an open borders policy. That'll be the immediate accusation. It doesn't lead to that, but it is connected to the issue that I mentioned earlier about the difference between the more ethno-nationalist, civic nationalist, and then the Lincoln-style, you know, creedal nation, propositional nationalist view, which says you're a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the idea that we're all created equal. It didn't say that all Americans were created equal. It says that all people are created equal. And we're trying to make a country built on that idea, but it's not an idea that's peculiar, that has a, you know, an exclusive application to the country. So I think there's got to be, let's hope, and I know we both have to go, but let's hope that this is the beginning of a larger conversation with us and other people, because it has to happen, and it's tough, as you say.
I just want to make one observation, and people who are reading the tea leaves will have noticed Bannon, and I think the president himself have said the nation state, or words to this effect, has shown itself to be the best model of political organization at the global scale, the nation state.
Yes.
What I want to observe is that can be true without reaching this question of humanitarian cosmopolitanism, because the question is, what kind of nation state? It doesn't obviate your borders to allow people to cross them.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. That'll be the beginning of the next conversation.
Excellent. Great job. Talk.
Thank you.
All right, signing off.
Signing off. Okay. Take care now.
Take care, Josh. Bye-bye. Okay.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.